I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
The next chapter.
With Sheila Rogers.
It was like discovering that you had this superpower.
Talk about this piercing novel and story that comes through.
Is this what a champion tree is?
The next chapter.
On CBC Radio 1.
And Sirius XM.
The identical twin sisters Tegan and Sarah bloomed early, and they've just kept on blooming. They formed a band when they were 15. A couple of years later, they made a demo album. And 2 years after that, they were touring with Neil Young. Tegan and Sarah grew up in 1990s Calgary. They captured that time in their memoir, High School. It's been adapted to a television series told from their alternating points of view, just like the book was. Tegan and Sarah return to those formative years in a graphic novel called Junior High, with artwork by Tilly Walden. It's their rock and roll origin story, and it explores the shifting nature of sisterhood at a time of great change. Tegan and Sarah open the program today. The Catcher in the Rye by J.D. Salinger has to be the all-time coming-of-age story. It came out 7 decades ago, and it still has great resonance. The creative force and artistic innovator Sandra LaRonde has reread The Catcher in the Rye, and she'll talk about it and recommend a classic Canadian book as a companion read. Sandra's on in half an hour. To close the program today, Amanda Lewis with her memoir of tracking some of the biggest trees in BC, Tracking Giants, Big Trees, Tiny Triumphs, and Misadventures in the Forest. I hope you'll stay with us. I'm Sheila Rogers. Welcome to the next chapter. There are times in our lives when we step over a threshold and leave who we were before to take on a new stage of life. Take grade 7, for instance. It's a portal from being a child to booming into a teenager. And it's exciting and scary and transformative. All those feelings run through Tegan and Sarah's new graphic novel, Junior High. It follows a year in the life of twins named Tegan and Sarah as they enter a new school in their hometown of Calgary. It's a lightly fictionalized account of growing up, coming out, and discovering who they are, together and apart. Junior High is illustrated by Tilly Walden, who, interestingly, is also a twin. Tegan Quinn and Sarah Quinn join me now from Vancouver. I'm so very happy to welcome you both to the next chapter. Back to the next chapter. Hi.
Hi. Oh, my goodness. We're so excited to be here. Thank you so much for that really beautiful introduction.
You're welcome. Thank you for being with us again. And you each introduce yourself and your family in the first pages of the book, and it's sort of a scene setter. Do you think, Tegan, you could do a version of that today to start off?
Yeah, so Junior High, as you so perfectly put, is a lightly fictionalized version of seventh grade. When Sarah and I were approached about writing a version of our middle grade experience, we shared a PowerPoint presentation with our publishers about what we actually experienced in seventh and eighth grade. And they were like, no, that's way too scary. We need to fictionalize your story and make it a little easier to read. And so Sarah and I, we decided that, yeah, fictionalizing the story and also modernizing it and moving our experience to the current times would be an interesting journey and exploration of our creativity. And it felt like the perfect place to start was the night before seventh grade begins. And so the book sort of starts with Tegan and Sarah, 12 turning 13, and their mom, Sonia, talking about what they're going to wear to school on first day of seventh grade. Our mom is named Sonia, and she was very cool. She had us when she was really young. She was 21. So my mom worked very hard to make us as cool as she possibly could for our arrival to junior high. And we resisted her at absolutely every corner. And so we showed up on the first day of seventh grade wearing, I wore a Mickey Mouse sweater and Sarah wore an Epcot t-shirt because we'd been to Florida that summer. And everyone else was wearing Club Monaco and Gap and had ponytails and makeup. We were complete losers. We got dumped by our boyfriends over the phone that afternoon. And we went home and begged my mom to let us wear her Doc Martens and her Converse and her Gap sweaters. And she helped to sort of semi-transform us, which isn't to say that everything in our life was about aesthetic, but I think my mom was like most moms. She was like, you guys are funny. You're cool. Be yourselves. Don't be followers. So yeah, the book opens with sort of this, you know, sweet, the sweet sort of first step into middle school, which is just, you know, figuring out who we are and how to hold on to as much of ourselves while also adapting to this sort of primal world of teens.
Yeah. And you know, Sarah, how was it for you to update it sort of 20 years after your own junior high experience, like when there were no iPhones, no possibility of texting and so on?
When we were writing the script, you know, we were doing our best to write authentically and not do it in a way that would be embarrassing. And we're obviously 42, not 13. So, but, you know, in talking about junior high, what I've come to realize is that in some ways, part of our career, part of our job really is using social media, the internet, and sort of reintroducing ourselves over and over and over again to the general public and, you know, and our audience. And that's not unlike what it, I think, probably feels like to be a teenager and deciding, well, this is what I like, and this is how I like to dress, and these are the types of people I'm attracted to or drawn to in friendship. And that sort of first independence that you feel like as a teenager or whatever, you know, in some ways it's easy to tap into that for me and Tegan, because we are kind of doing that with each new album cycle or each new creative project that we're launching into the world. And so, you know, for example, you know, you've mentioned, you know, when we were growing up, we didn't have cell phones or social media, which is totally true. But I think because we, Tegan and I, have to adapt to these new changes in communication and social media because of our job, I know exactly what it feels like to awkwardly join TikTok and try to figure out what kind of videos to post that will be popular and which ones suck, and, you know, and navigate the peer pressure, you know, in our business, for example, around like becoming somebody who adopts these technologies or somebody who thrives with these technologies or somebody who resists them and feels like an outsider. So, you know, when we were writing the book, I didn't think a ton about it, but I think it came very naturally for us to write about that awkward navigation because we're actually doing it in our adult lives.
So. Yeah. Tegan, in the novel, Tegan is more nervous than Sarah back on that first day of school. How would you describe your emotional dynamic back then?
Oh my goodness. I mean, I was a mess the first day of school every year until eighth grade. So, you know, starting in preschool, I was always the one who cried. And Sarah was always very stoic and supportive. And, you know, teachers would come get, you know, or a student would go and get Sarah from her class and be like, your sister's really upset. And she would have to come and console me. And it only ever lasted the first day of school. And I had absolutely no control over it. And it's so embarrassing, but like we write about it in junior high, again, in a sweet way. But in reality, I didn't cry in the classroom in seventh grade when we started junior high. Mercifully, my body did control itself, but I was sick like the month leading up to the start of junior high. I'm not sure what was wrong with me that in seventh grade I was still feeling that way, but yeah, I think it, you know, first experiences are really hard for me. They still are, you know. Yeah, I still struggle with doing something for the first time. So that's carried with me. And we definitely tried to grab a few of those funny little weird personality traits for this story, you know, because I think some of our weird neurosis and some of our funny little isms, you know, really started to show and shine at that junior high age. So I think there's lots of that kind of adult thinking in this book, which is why I think it's like a book that, though it's aimed at a younger audience, will be appealing to a lot of different ages. Cause like, I think there's a lot in the book that we insert that's based on reflecting back, you know, with the luxury of adult thinking.
Can I just have a word for like first bra? I remember that as it was just so difficult, and I didn't even get a bra. I got a training bra. Like, what are they being trained to do? Like, I just, it was so awful. Anyway, I love the chapter on bras. Like, it just really brought it home. But yeah, it's everything's a first. Everything's a first. First party. First love. First crush. First, yeah.
Also, too, I mean, not that we've like broken crazy new ground here with our storytelling, but I think a lot of girls have the experience of wanting to get their period, wanting to get their first bras. Like, these are pretty normal. Shaving your legs, getting makeup, like those are pretty normalized, I guess, like milestones in being a certain type of girl anyways. And Tegan and I didn't want any of those things to happen. You know, our adolescence was pretty much spent wishing that we would be exempt. You know, like, I remember thinking, like, maybe I won't get my period. Like, maybe there'll be something, you know, biologically, you know, askew, and I'll be one of the lucky ones. You know, like, I remember really processing, you know, with myself, like, I just didn't want that. I didn't know why I didn't want that, but I knew that that wasn't what I wanted. And so we really wanted to try to capture a slightly different version of, you know, these milestones that happen in kids' lives. Even the party, you know, that again is really based on a real life experience of hosting our first co-ed, like, boys and girls Halloween party, and just like the awkwardness of like wanting it to be a success and then sort of overwhelmed by the social realities of having a successful party.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, you know, the expectations you had and the sort of rules that you create, like, don't talk too much about parents and don't look lost. And then some of the other things you learn really early on, but you weren't expecting, like people who weren't nice. Who do the twins meet who's not nice?
Well, so this was a challenge for Sarah and I when we were writing the book, because again, you know, we had the luxury of being able to modernize the story and fictionalize it, which was exciting, you know, because we're thrilled to have the opportunity to write something for a younger audience and to share some of our wisdom and to also share in the sort of universal, like, oh my God, being young is so hard. You know, I think as public figures, you sort of put on this very curated, very perfect version of yourself for the world, especially these days with social media. And, you know, our journey the last 5 years, writing a memoir and developing it for TV and then having this opportunity with junior high for a young audience, is to say, we're not perfect. We didn't do everything right. We didn't know everything. We made lots of mistakes. We're not that cool, you know? And to have the opportunity to do that for a younger audience was really exciting. But for Sarah and I, sort of getting that ratio right, like of how much reality to put into it and then how much to fictionalize, was sort of something we tinkered with through multiple drafts of junior high. Because when we went to junior high, we made some really amazing friends that we are still friends with to this day. But we also came across kids that in hindsight were really brutal, really mean, bullied us, bullied other people, bullied each other, you know, didn't have the same maybe family support or the same, you know, structure and opportunity to learn how to be a good person, maybe weren't coached the same way we were by our family to be leaders, to, you know, stick up for ourselves, to be kind, to be, you know, respectful to adults. And so, you know, with hindsight, it's like even the worst kids that we came up against in junior high, we're just kids, you know, who just didn't have the same opportunities we did. And we were far from perfect, by the way. I mean, you know, we did lots of crappy stuff. And so the luxury of this book and fictionalizing it was we got to take out all the crappy things we did, all the mistakes we made. But we also got to soften some of the bullies and the kids that we ran into and give them a little bit more nuance and have empathy for them. So in the book, you know, Tegan and Sarah are immediately sort of adopted by a cool kid who has a bunch of other girlfriends who are kind of mean, and they kind of bully Tegan and Sarah because they're the new kids and they're cool and hip and shiny because they're twins and everybody really likes them. And so they kind of come up against a girl in particular who's competitive with Tegan over this new shared friend. And, you know, Sarah inserted a story that's sort of loosely based on her experience coming to terms with her sexuality, where it's like, we all of a sudden had gym class where you have to change in the locker room. And like, that was really traumatizing when we started seventh grade. You know, it's like you're having to figure out how to change without taking your clothes off. And so we tried to insert some of that humor, like of those cringy first moments where you like put a t-shirt over top of the t-shirt and then you pull your sleeves out and you try to like wiggle out of your clothes. And then just like kind of the shyness and awkwardness of seeing other girls half undressed and, you know, again, coming to terms with your sexuality and being fearful that maybe someone would mistake you casually looking over at them as, you know, prying or checking them out. And so we inserted some of those kinds of stories into the book. But yeah, we kind of adapted them to be a little softer.
There's just such a beautiful moment in the story, among many, but this one's really graphic because you find your stepdad's guitar. And you and Sarah start to play, and all of a sudden, then this is what I mean by graphic, the world turns to color, and so do the illustrations. Sarah, what did the discovery of music mean for you?
Well, I use the word joy a lot when I think back on that moment of realizing that music, which was something so prevalent, so dominant in our environment, you know, the stereo always on in the house, the stereo on in the car. Our grandparents had a jukebox in their basement and sometimes would have bands play like on New Year's Eve, or music was just absolutely everywhere. And that moment where we went from being listeners to performers happened truly like overnight. And it was like magic. It was joyful. It was like discovering that you had this superpower. That you could do the thing that you loved that other people could do. And now you were part of that. And, you know, the way that Tilly Walden, the cartoonist who drew the book, captured it using this kind of like infusion of color into the story, you know, is so accurate. It really did feel like our life just suddenly got bigger. It just made more sense. I felt like I had purpose, you know, and I think it's not uncommon for young people to feel like they suddenly aren't the center of the world. You know, when you're a little kid, the whole world, I mean, I say this right now as a new parent. I don't know how my son couldn't feel like he's not the center of the world. I mean, we worship him, you know, I mean, he's just, everything about him is what's important to us. And then I think you arrive into adolescence and you realize like, oh, everything isn't going to just be about me. And I think there's this almost lashing out that happens to sort of find your voice, to feel, you know, heard. And in some ways, music was the antidote to all of those feelings of voicelessness and invisibility. It was a way of us making ourselves realized in a way that felt comfortable. You know, it wasn't me having to stand up and say, this is how I feel, everyone. It was me saying, oh, I have a new song. And then here's all my feelings. You know, and if you're listening really hard, you'll probably know what I'm trying to say. It just felt like a superpower.
And Tegan, you play your first show for friends and for your parents, and the band is called Gunk. What was your first band in real life, and what was it like?
So when Sarah and I started playing music, it was in 10th grade, actually. In reality, we found the guitar. The story's the same, but we found the guitar but when we were a little older. But we started writing songs secretly, and my parents came home from work one day, and we didn't hear them because we were hiding the fact that we'd taken this guitar and we're writing songs. And they came kind of busting in and we're like, what on earth is happening? And we're really excited. And right away, Sarah and I, we had begun recording ourselves. We had just, you know, a double tape deck. And so we would sit there and record each other and tape versions of these songs. And we started to dub them and give them out to friends. And we got a lot of positive feedback right away. And it was really exciting. I mean, we, you know, had sort of discovered this thing that we could do and we wanted to share it with everybody. And I can remember very quickly, I mean, quicker than I thought, you know, when we were writing our memoir, we interviewed a lot of people we'd gone to high school with, and they had a lot of notes and journals about the experience. So they remembered better than us based on these materials, like that we started writing in the early part of 10th grade, and we were already sharing music with people and saying things like, we're going to be famous, when we were like in November of 10th grade. So it was like, it only took us 2 months to decide this was our new path, but you know, it was a joy. It's exhilarating to perform on stage, but when you're young and you're first starting out, it's exhilarating just to perform for each other. Like Sarah and I would race home from school and play each other songs that we had been working on. And you know, invite friends over, and we dragged our guitars with us everywhere. It makes me cringe now, because I would rather, like, I never want to have to carry our guitar anywhere. Like, I'm like, ew, it's so geeky. Someone carry it for me. I have no idea what that's about. But as young people, we were so proud of ourselves that we could do this thing. We loved doing it. We would take the bus to school with our guitars, and then, you know, we would play out back at school at lunch for our friends. And we just loved it. I loved the feeling in my body of performing. I loved closing my eyes, singing a song, and then finishing the song, and you open your eyes and everyone's just smiling at you, like amazed, like you've done something amazing, you know?
And you did. And you did. Sarah, a couple of years ago, you and Tegan co-wrote the memoir High School. Now, as we've mentioned, a lovely TV series, charming. And now there's this graphic novel, Junior High. What has this deep dive into those years meant to you?
Well, I mean, in some ways, a lot of these projects, the sort of genesis for them was, one very specific moment in our career, and the thrust of writing these projects and really diving back into this time period musically and the writing and the sort of archive. It all sort of happened right before the pandemic and sort of in the early months of the pandemic. And I think the catharsis of being transported back to, you know, this period of our lives that was also really tough and really strange and unknown, I felt like there was like a parallel, you know, like I was sort of like going back to this really troubling and traumatizing time and taking a lot of comfort in how much we overcame and how our instincts were strong back then and we got through it. And we were in this part of our career where we were sort of like, you know, reflecting on like what comes next in our lives. And then there's a giant pandemic. And I just remember taking a lot of like comfort in teenage Tegan and Sarah and thinking to myself, God, remember this time that was just so much simpler before we were adults, before we were successful musicians, you know, before we were in a pandemic. Like there was just something about traveling back to those versions of us that was just a tremendous gift. And I think in some ways, not to be, gosh, this feels a little bit, it feels a little bit cheesy to say, but it was very healing. And, you know, going back and sort of forgiving ourselves for things that we maybe I didn't even realize, you know, I needed to kind of forgive myself for certain kinds of things. And I needed to make space also to be angry and sort of sad about certain things that had happened in my teenage years and my young adulthood. I feel like I kind of have traveled out of that period now of my life with a lot of closure. I feel like that time of my life, I really understand it now through an adult lens. And I feel like I'm moving into a new period of my life, you know, as an artist, but also as a new mom, with a better understanding of who I am and how I got here.
Mm. And there's more, but wait, there's more. Crush. There's going to be another one in this series.
Yes. We just actually saw that we finished writing the script for Crush during the pandemic, but we actually just saw the first draft of it from Tilly Walden, the cartoonist, who's working on book two, and it just looks fabulous. We're really, really delighted about the second installment in the series.
Looking forward to it myself, and it's just been, well, can I say a joy? It has been, though, for me to speak with you both. Tegan and Sarah, thank you so much.
Oh my gosh, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Tegan Quinn and Sarah Quinn, the authors of the graphic novel Junior High, illustrated by Tilly Walden. Tegan and Sarah with Faded Like a Feeling.
I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of 6 darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. You understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Cody Catano, author of Half Bads and White Regalia. and you're listening to The Next Chapter with Sheila Rogers on CBC Radio 1.
As the founder of Red Sky Performance, Sandra LaRonde has created and produced powerful performance works that always center Indigenous story. She has received many accolades for her visionary creations, combining music, dance, and theater. In the fall, she added writer to her resume when she published her debut novel for young readers. She Holds Up the Stars is a coming-of-age story about a young girl who wants to leave the city to live with her grandmother on the reserve. Sandra has just reread one of the all-time classic coming-of-age stories, The Catcher in the Rye, by J.D. Salinger, and Sandra joins me now to talk about it and the Canadian companion book she recommends. And she joins me from Edmonton for a very special reason, because she is receiving the highest honor that Indigenous people can bestow upon its own people, an Inspire Award for the Arts. Sandra, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much, Sheila.
Pleasure. How does it feel?
It's exciting. We haven't had the actual ceremony yet, so I know it's going to be very moving and very special.
And it will be broadcast later on in the season. If I were with you right now, I would shake your hand right off. I really would. It's such a beautiful thing. So it's lovely to see you recognized this way.
Oh, thank you.
Let's talk about The Catcher in the Rye. I was just thinking about it. We had to take it in high school, and it was published back in 1951. And I guess young people have been reading it for 7 decades, which is incredible. This story of Holden Caulfield. What took you back to the novel?
Well, you know, after writing my first novel, which is for young adults and children, it really made me want to read other works. And I thought it'd be so interesting to go back to some of the books that I read in high school or as a young adult. And so I went back to Catcher in the Rye because it comes up in so many movies and stories. And I thought, I'm going to read that classic as an adult. And what would that be like reading it now? And it was very different reading it now as an adult than when I was, like, I don't know how old, 14, 15 years of age. And it's interesting because at that time, there was no category called YA, young right. adult novels. That only came later in, I think, around 1960 with The Outsiders. And prior to that, Catcher in the Rye, Huckleberry Finn, all these incredible classics, everybody read, no matter what age they were. So right. I don't know why they did that, because unfortunately what happens, I think, is people sometimes think, well, that's a book for youth or a book for children,
yes.
so it doesn't really affect my life. But they're incredible novels and so much wisdom in them and insight and youth. And children understand far more than we give them credit for. Mm-hmm. And Catcher in the Rye and other books like that spoke up to youth and children. They didn't speak down. I think that's one of the reasons why adults enjoyed them so much as well.
Remind us, what happens to Holden Caulfield over the course of the story?
Well, Holden is 16 years of age, living in New York City. He is expelled from a prep school, Pensy Prep School, and it takes place over, I think it's just over a weekend or a few days, and it's more of his sort of internal world, the way he sees life, and it's really told through the first person, so you really get a sense that he's speaking to you, but he really, you know, rails against the phoniness of the adult world, and so he starts to do very poorly in school, because his brother died of leukemia, Ali, and his father's a lawyer. So he's from a well-to-do family and big expectations of what he needs to fulfill in his life. And so when he's expelled, he goes off and he meets all of these incredible characters from, you know, everyday people, from prostitutes, from I think even some of the occult, like he's just really meeting all sorts of people in New York City.
which is this incredible city, as you know. But the one thing that really impressed upon me as an adult reading, I have to say, is, you know, how young people and children and have to navigate this world that is full of predators. Yeah. You know, that really touched me when I read it this time. And I definitely didn't see it in that way when I was young.
So interesting. Mm-hmm. I remember when I read it, and I have not reread it since I was a teenager, but how astute he was at detecting what he called phoniness. And phony is a word that comes up in Catcher in the Rye a lot. I remember making a note about that. But this is a very perceptive young man, and he's sort of pierced by his experiences and recognizes beauty. And there's just so much going on in his world. And I remember reading it and feeling my world is big like that too.
Yes. And the other thing that struck me was just the unflinching honesty about everything, even about himself and his family and the world around him. And, you know, the feeling of alienation, because at that time there was a lot of YA books that were really sort of Pollyanna. And so talk about this piercing novel and story that comes through, and it's the counterpoint. You know, it's about the underbelly of all of that, and told through the eyes of a very young boy, a young man, and asking those big questions about a big life, you know, about identity and morality, connection and disconnection and running away and, you know, and facing tragedy at a young age. So it's an extraordinary book. It really is.
Well, I'm interested in the classic that you're going to recommend as a matchup read for The Catcher in the Rye. What is that book?
So I would like to recommend, it's a book called Half Breed. It's written by Maria Campbell, and it is also a classic. Mm-hmm. It's an Indigenous classic, and it comes from this pen by this woman who's an extraordinary storyteller, and she wrote this book in 1973, so 50 years ago now, and really was one of the few places in Canada to really talk about the kind of oppression and racism and tragedy and what she had to overcome in her life. So it's about her trajectory, born and raised in northern Saskatchewan as a very spirited girl, a lot of pluck and adventure. And she was related actually to Gabrielle Dumont, who fought with Louis Riel in the Northwest Rebellion of 1885. So her book starts out in this sort of historical context of which she comes from. And so her life, I remember now rereading it, I could remember the way she described her home, you know, with the black stove that heated the log home, but it also was the place where they cooked. And this, I remember like the roots and the herbs that you could smell. I just remember the sensorial sort of, especially through the senses of her describing that home when I read it when I was 18 or 19 years of age. So it's about her, and then she was very close to her grandmother, and her mother died when she was 15, and she ends up going to Western Canada in Alberta and Vancouver, and ends up getting caught up with drugs and alcohol and living on the streets and really not protected at all. And very much this novel uses her own life as this trajectory of Métis woman, you know, of a mixed blood woman, and the trajectory of displacement and living as a single mother, substance abuse, poverty, sexual abuse, etc. But it's really about that displacement and disenfranchisement of her people. And then what is extraordinary about Maria, though, is that she transforms all of this. She transforms it to becoming, you know, a politicized person, an author, an agent of change. She has agency. She always did have agency. That's the one thing I loved about her character very, very much. And, you know, she's inspired so many people, Indigenous writers, artists, filmmakers. And I mean, she's still alive to this day and living in Northern Saskatchewan. And I mean, there's differences, but there's also incredible similarities between her life and Holden Caulfield's life. Or J.D. Salinger, really.
I think it's an incredible and wonderful choice to go with reading The Catcher in the Rye. And I can't help but think you share a lot with Maria, who is an amazing storyteller on many media, playwright, filmmaker, writer. She's even a rapper. I'm sure you've seen the Kokum rap, which is just fantastic. And always an esteemed elder. And this book was just so essential and groundbreaking. I think in the same way that The Catcher in the Rye was. So I think this is a wonderful, wonderful matchup, Sandra. And I want to thank you so much for it.
Thank you so much. And I appreciate sharing this time with you, Sheila.
Me too. Thanks, Sandra, very, very much. And once again, congratulations.
Jimmy Quich, thank you.
Sandra Laurent is the author of She Holds Up the Stars and the coming-of-age books she recommends as great companion reads are on our website, cbc.ca/thenextchapter. In June of 2018, Amanda Lewis had been back in her hometown of Vancouver for a year. She wanted to commemorate her year of living in Vancouver, and so in an effort to be healthy and to explore, she decided that during the next 12 months, she would see all of British Columbia's champion trees. Champion trees are the largest trees in the province, and some of them are the largest trees in the world. There were 43 of them at the time, all documented on British Columbia's Big Tree Registry. Amanda embarked on her quest with a combination of zeal, a bit of tree knowledge, and not much wilderness experience. She's written about her journey of discovery in Tracking Giants, Big Trees, Tiny Triumphs, and Misadventures in the Forest. Amanda Lewis joins me now from her home on Gabriola Island, British Columbia. Amanda, welcome to The Next Chapter.
Thank you so much, Sheila. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, you've been here before in a sense, because I know you have edited books by writers that we've spoken to on this program. So your presence has been felt, if it hasn't been if it hasn't been named. And also, I know that you were going through some burnout because of your work in Toronto, and you moved to the West Coast. And that sort of ties up with celebrating your year in Vancouver, wanting to get healthy and to go out and explore. But I want to ask you, first of all, if you close your eyes right now and I say the words champion tree, what image is on your eyelids?
Ooh, well, the tree that pops to mind is Big Lonely Doug, which is this huge coastal Douglas fir in Port Renfrew on Vancouver Island. And the irony of it is it's not even a champion tree. You know, it's the second biggest in BC and the second biggest in Canada. The champion tree is this Red Creek fir, which grows nearby. But what I like about Big Lonely Doug as a champion in my mind is it's like a quintessential Douglas fir. It's 66 meters tall. Mm. It's almost 4 meters diameter, and it's perfect, almost perfectly straight, and has these, you know, big leaders, so the big branches in its crown. But what's unique about Big Lonely Doug is it grows alone, hence the name Big Lonely Doug. It grows in this clear cut.
Big Lonely Doug had an indirect influence on your book. What was that?
Well, it's actually kind of the spark tree for my book, in that when I was thinking about, I was back on the coast for a year, and I was going out into the North Shore Mountains near my home in East Vancouver and hiking more. And me being me, I wanted to put a little shape on these excursions. It couldn't just be a hike. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll start a blog to commemorate some of these visits and inspire other people to get out into the woods. And I mentioned this to my friend Kate Harris, who is an author, and she wrote Lands of Lost Borders about biking the Silk Road from Istanbul to India. And I said, you know, I'm thinking of starting a blog to commemorate some of these hikes. And she didn't use the word boring, but she had a better idea, and that she'd read an early copy of this book, Big Lonely Doug, by Harley Rustad. And in that, she learned about this BC Big Tree Registry and the champion trees, which are the biggest trees of their species. And she said, why don't you go see all these champion trees? You know, which is a thing I could expect from someone who decided to cycle the Silk Road. And me being me, I agreed on the spot, and I launched a blog the next day, and I decided to just visit these huge trees.
The first champion tree you see is the Scowler's Willow. And you say it was like seeing the Mona Lisa for the first time. Tell us about that.
Well, I remember, you know, being in Paris and waiting to see the Mona Lisa and standing in line for well over an hour and thinking, oh, this is really going to be worth it. You know, because you see the Mona Lisa and you think this is known to be one of the greatest paintings, and it has a deep meaning, and I will be able to tap into that meaning when I'm in front of it. And I remember finally shouldering up to this painting and feeling nothing, like really just feeling the presence of people behind me, and I should hurry along now, and trying to absorb it in the 2 seconds that I had in front of it. And it was kind of a similar experience with seeing the Scowler's Willow in Vancouver, because I thought, you know, this tree is going to light me up with a feeling of transcendence and all my questions will be answered. And when I found the willow, I was more like, is this the willow? I'm not sure. What does a Scowler's Willow look like? Oh, I'm feeling pretty tired. I got to go to the bathroom. I'm pretty hungry. I think, you know, I got to go get an ice cream cone. Like, I just totally forgot this idea of transcendence. And I couldn't connect to the tree at all.
It isn't the only time and the only tree that left you feeling little excitement. You write about being underwhelmed when you saw a bitter cherry champion tree near a transit hub in North Vancouver. Why do you think you didn't experience the feelings that you had expected?
I think because I had given those feelings of transcendence to the biggest trees. So I grew up in Surrey outside of Vancouver and was really used to playing among and even in some of these stumps of these big trees. So the biggest were the ones that I had thought, okay, these are the ones that will transport me. And the bitter cherry and other smaller trees, I felt like were my warm-up to seeing these bigger trees. And what was particularly underwhelming about the bitter cherry is people didn't know it was there. You know, commuters were walking past it all the time, twice a day, and it was growing in this overgrown lot just on a curb and totally covered in vines. It didn't look special at all. It was ringed by garbage. And I thought, is this what a champion tree is? It just didn't have any marker of specialness about it.
And how did that alter your perception of your pursuit?
Well, my perception of my pursuit just kept changing through the whole project. And the bitter cherry was one of my early wins. And it was just a 20-minute drive from my home. And I thought, wow, all the trees are going to be this easy to find.
But what made finding the trees so challenging beyond, you know, how the tree itself might have changed?
I mean, the expression a needle in a haystack comes to mind, because looking for a tree in a forest is very challenging. Big trees tend to grow together. So if you find big trees, you're generally looking at a few of them. And I didn't know which one would be the biggest. I wasn't confident in my measuring at that time. And these trees grow sometimes way off the beaten path. So the bitter cherry, you know, you could actually take the bus there. It was right by the transit hub. Very easy to get to. But some of these other trees, like subalpine fir or big cedars, they just grow way down logging roads. And I learned not to step off the path too much, because I would surely get lost.
You write that your background as a books editor helped you reframe your project into something more creative and inspiring. How did that background change your tree tracking project?
Well, at the beginning, I really judged myself for not knowing more about the forest because I grew up here on the coast and I should know more about these trees. And, you know, arborists and forest techs, I told myself those are the ones who should be doing this project. And editors are really used to getting it right. You know, like we're trained to spot typos and grammatical errors. But one of the hallmarks of an editor's training is that eventually she learns how to look at the bigger book and ask questions. And once I realized that the project wasn't necessarily about seeing the trees, but could be reframed as a creative project, I thought, ah, I know this. I know this world very well. It's the creative process. And generally, when writers start on a book, they have a huge idea, and then they have to think about how they're going to pull it off, and then they're faced with self-doubt, and then they have to reframe it. And I know this world so well because that's what I do. And I realized that I was acting like a writer in the WITS, and I needed to act more like an editor. So to know that the ending would shift and that it was going to take a bit longer and that I could ask questions. So then I started to ask questions of the trees, like, huh, which tree grows with which? What kind of tree are you? And actually speaking directly to the trees, which sounds kind of woo-woo, but it was a great way to just slow down and spend time with these trees.
I don't think it sounds woo-woo at all. But then I guess, you know, I just think the trees have a lot to tell us, and Indigenous people have known this, you know, since time immemorial. It's a rich experience to accompany you on your journey, Amanda. Thank you so much. Thanks for the book, and thank you for this conversation.
Well, thank you so much.
Amanda Lewis, the author of Tracking Giants, Big Trees, Tiny Triumphs, and Misadventures in the Forest. She joined me from Gabriola Island, BC. And that's our program for this week. Jacqueline Kirk is our senior producer, with Lisa Matthews and me. Thanks also this week to Barb Carey, Sarah Cooper, and to the CBC Books digital team, as always. Coming up next week, Michelle Good, the author of the very best-selling debut novel, Five Little Indians. Michelle returns with a new book. It's an essay collection called Truth Telling, Seven Conversations About Indigenous Life in Canada. And from St. John's, Holly Hogan, with her book Message in a Bottle, Ocean Dispatches from a Seabird Biologist. I hope you'll tune in then. You may have heard that after 43 years, the last 15 of which have been here at The Next Chapter, I'm going to be leaving the CBC at the end of this season. I want to thank everyone who's written in so very nicely, kindly, generously, with congratulations and well wishes. And as I leave you today, here are some farewells from writers whom I've had the honor of speaking with over the years. I'm Sheila Rogers. Thank you for listening to The Next Chapter.
Rogers, it's Dave Robertson. I just wanted to come on here and congratulate you for 15 years as host of The Next Chapter. What a run. I got my first book published about 15 years ago, so you have been there with me literally my entire career. You've always been so supportive of me, as much as you've been supportive of so many writers and artists over the years. And over that time, you've become not only my friend, but my family. And I just wanted to say that I love you, and I have a great idea for what you can do next. This might be a bit of an inside joke, but I'm here for it. And that is riding in cars with riders. I'll co-host with you, and I'll just ride your coattails. But anyway, congratulations. Love you, and can't wait to see what you do next.
Hi, Sheila. It's me, your old friend, Jensuk Fong Lee. It's been 15 years since you started on The Next Chapter, and I think it's been 15 years since you first interviewed me when my first novel came out, when I was just a sprout and you were in love with my dear old dog, Molly, whose name, by the way, you always remembered, even when you forgot my ex-husband's name, which, fair. What I will miss most is the deep empathy you always had for the big topics I was trying to tackle in my writing, especially the topic that you and I talked about the most, which was motherhood and its reverberations. I swear we could talk for years just on that one thing. There is really no one I would rather talk to about books and the ways in which art and culture can connect us all. But what I will really miss the most is when I would tell a silly little joke on air and I would make you laugh, because you have the best, most infectious laugh in the whole world. Sheila, you're the best. You have been the best on the air all this time, and I will love you always.
Danse, and hello, Sheila. Gregory Schofield here. Sheila, nihti, my heart, my friend. How can I express what you've given to Canadians, and in particular, to Canadian writers? I've known you, Sheila, to be a gentle voice that has led us through stories, that has made us sit with our truths and heartaches, with our own histories, both new and old. Niti, my heart, how can I personally express my gratitude for the space you've created for Indigenous writers, our songs and stories, our histories and healing? I've sat across from you many times and I've sang. I've sang while you wore my story like a yoke of stars. Niti, may these stars and stories always keep you warm. May you walk into new dreams the way you have led us back to our own, back to our own stories, back to ourselves. My heart, Niti, Kisagitin. I love you. Hai hai and merci for all that you've done and all you continue to do.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.